Chapter 2. The Dark Power of Atrocity. The Problem. Righteousness comes out of a gun barrel. On a cold, rainy training day at Fort Lewis, Washington, I listened to soldiers talk who had just completed a prisoner of war exercise. One held that the enemy troops should be marched through an area saturated with persistent nerve gas. Another stated that the Claymore mine presented the most cost-effective and energy-efficient method of disposing of POWs. His buddy claimed that they were both being wasteful and that POWs could best be used for minefield clearing and reconnaissance for nuclear and chemical contaminated areas. The battalion chaplain, who was standing nearby, began to address this obvious moral issue. The chaplain cited the Geneva Conventions and discussed our nation as a force of righteousness and the support of God for our cause. To pragmatic soldiers, this moral approach didn't go far. The Geneva Convention was dismissed, and our forward observer said that in school, they had told him that the Geneva Convention says you can't fire white phosphorus at troops, so you call it in on their equipment. The young artilleryman's logic was, if we're going to find ways around the Geneva Convention, what do you think the enemy is going to do? Another said, if we get captured by the Russians, we might as well kiss it off, so why not give them a dose of the same medicine? To the chaplain's righteousness and support of God comments, the cold, wet soldier's answers were along the lines of righteousness comes out of a gun barrel, and the victor writes history. At Fort Benning, I too had heard the Geneva Convention on White Phosphorus on Equipment Line during the artillery pitch in Officer Kennedy School, the Infantry Officer Basic Course, Ranger School, and the Infantry Mortar Platoon Officer's Course. The treatment of POWs had been addressed by an instructor at Ranger School, and he clearly communicated his personal belief that in a raid or an ambush, a patrol could not be expected to take POWs. I had noted that most of the outstanding young soldiers coming to us from the Ranger Battalion shared this Ranger School belief. A solution. I'll shoot you myself. To confront this belief, I said basically, if the enemy finds just one massacre, like our soldiers did at Malmedy in the Battle of the Bulge, then thousands of enemy soldiers will swear never to surrender, and they'll be very tough to fight, just like our troops were in the Battle of the Bulge when word got around that the Germans were shooting POWs. In addition, that's all the excuse the enemy needs to kill our captured soldiers. So by murdering a few prisoners, who are just poor, tired soldiers like you, you'll make the enemy force a damn sight tougher and cause the deaths, murders, of a whole bunch of our boys. On the other hand, if you disarm, tie up, and leave a POW out in a clearing somewhere because you can't take them with you, then the word will spread that Americans treat POWs honorably, even when the chips are down, and a whole bunch of scared, tired soldiers will surrender rather than die. In World War II, an entire Soviet Army Corps defected to the Germans. The Germans were treating Soviet POWs like dogs, and yet a whole corps came over to their side. How would they behave if they faced a humane enemy? The last thing you ought to know is that if I ever catch any of you heroes killing a POW, I'll shoot you right on the spot. Because it's illegal, because it's wrong, because it's dumb, and it's one of the worst things you could do to help us win a war. I didn't bother to include the possibility of organizing Soviet POWs and defectors into combat units, and the very real importance of capturing POWs for intelligence purposes. The lesson and the greater problem. The most important point here is that nobody has ever pointed out to me the potential repercussions of improper POW handling. No leader of mine has ever stood up and clearly stated this position to me and defended it. In fact, the opposite has occurred. As a private and a sergeant, I have had enlisted superiors strongly defend the execution of POWs whenever it was inconvenient to take them alive, and at the time I accepted it as reasonable. But they never made me understand the vital importance and the deadly ramifications of POW handling or mishandling on the battlefield, because I think they themselves did not understand. On the next battlefield, our soldiers may commit war crimes, and thereby cause us to lose one of the basic combat multipliers that we have available to us, the tendency of an oppressed people to become disloyal to their nation. One interviewer of World War II POWs told me that German soldiers repeatedly told him that relatives with World War I combat experience had advised, be brave, join the infantry, and surrender to the first American you see. The American reputation for fair play and respect for human life had survived over generations, and the decent actions of American soldiers in World War I had saved the lives of many soldiers in World War II. This is America's position on the role of atrocity in combat, and this is the logic behind it. But there is another position that many nations have taken on the use of atrocity in warfare, and there is another logic to be considered. This other logic is the twisted logic of atrocity, which we must understand if we are to completely understand killing. The empowerment. Quote, "War has no power to transform. It merely exaggerates the good and the evil that are in us." Lord Moran, Anatomy of Courage. Empowerment through death. The first time I saw a soldier plummet to his death in a parachute jump, it took years to sort out my emotions. Part of me was horrified at this soldier's death. But as I watched him fight his tangled reserve chute all the way down, another part of me was filled with pride. His death validated and affirmed all that I believe about paratroopers, who stare death in the face daily. That brave, doomed soldier became a living sacrifice to the spirit of the airborne. After talking to my fellow paratroopers and drinking a toast to the memory of our departed comrade, I began to understand that his death had magnified our own belief in the danger, nobility, and superiority inherent in our elite unit. Instead of being diminished by his loss, we were strangely magnified and empowered by it. This phenomenon is not limited to, although it is always present in, elite fighting units. Nations celebrate their costliest battles, even losing ones. The Alamo, Pickett's Charge, Dunkirk, Wake Island, and Leningrad are examples, due to the bravery and nobility of the sacrifice involved. Empowerment through atrocity. As churlish as it might be to compare the death of a paratrooper in an airborne action with the sacrifice of the Jews in World War II, I believe that the same process that existed in me when I saw a soldier die exists in a greatly magnified form among those who commit atrocities. The Holocaust is sometimes misunderstood as the senseless killing of Jews and innocent people, but this killing was not senseless. Vile and evil, but not senseless. Such murders have a very powerful but twisted logic of their own, a logic that we must understand if we are to confront it. There are many benefits reaped by those who tap the dark power of atrocity. Those who engage in a policy of atrocity usually strike a bargain that exchanges their future for a brief gain in the present. Though brief, that gain is nonetheless real and powerful. In order to understand the attraction of atrocity, we must understand and clearly acknowledge those benefits that cause individuals, groups, and nations to turn to it. Terrorism. One of the most obvious and blatant benefits of atrocity is that it quite simply scares the hell out of people. The raw horror and savagery of those who murder and abuse cause people to flee, hide, and defend themselves feebly, and often their victims respond with mute passivity. We see this in the newspapers daily, when we read of victims who are faced with mass murders and simply do nothing to protect themselves or others. Hannah Arendt noted this failure to resist the Nazis in her study, The Banality of Evil. Jeff Cooper, writing from experience in criminology, comments on this tendency in civilian life. Any study of the atrocity list of recent years shows immediately that the victims, by their appalling ineptitude and timidity, virtually assisted in their own murders. Any man who is a man may not, in honor, submit to threats of violence, but many men who are not cowards are simply unprepared for the fact of human savagery. They have not thought about it, incredible as this may appear to anyone who reads the papers or listens to the news, and they just don't know what to do. When they look right in the face of depravity or violence, they are astonished and confounded. This process that empowers criminals and outcasts in society can work even better when institutionalized as policy by revolutionary organizations, armies, and governments. North Vietnam and its Viet Cong proxies represented one force that blatantly used atrocity as a policy and was triumphant because of it. In 1959, 250 South Vietnamese officials were assassinated by the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong found that assassination was easy. It was cheap, and it worked. A year later, this toll of murder and atrocity went up to 1,400, and it continued for 12 more years. Throughout these years, the attrition warfare advocates in the United States visited impotent, futile bombings upon the North. The methodology and targets of these bombings made them very ineffectual compared with the strategic bombing conducted in World War II. Yet our own post-World War II studies showed that in England and Germany, little was accomplished by such bombings, except to steel the resolve of the enemy. But while the United States was fruitlessly bombing the North was efficiently murdering the infrastructure of the South, one by one in their beds and homes. As we have seen before, death from 20,000 feet is strangely impersonal and psychologically impotent. But death up close and personal, visiting the manifest intensity of the enemy's wind of hate upon its victims, such death can be hideously effective at sapping the will of the enemy and ultimately achieving victory. His squad with a death order entered the house of a prominent community leader and shot him, his wife, his married son, and daughter-in-law, a male and female servant, and their baby. The family cat was strangled, the family dog was clubbed to death, and the goldfish scooped out of the fishbowl and tossed onto the floor. When the communists left, no life remained in the house. A family unit had been eliminated. Jim Graves, The Tangled Web. Interestingly, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces in Afghanistan and Iraq also use atrocity. But in some ways, they were considerably more clumsy and counterproductive in wielding these tools. One former high-level North Vietnamese commander was asked to give his assessment of the tactics used by the forces the U.S. faced in Afghanistan and Iraq. He stated that our opponents erred greatly by using indiscriminate killings, mostly with suicide bombs and car bombs, and by attacking mainland America, two mistakes that North Vietnam sought always to avoid. Thus, atrocity can be a powerful tool, but it is also a wretched and hateful servant that must be kept on a very short leash, lest it turn on its would-be masters and deny them even short-term benefits. And yet there is, undeniably, a simple, horrifying, and obvious value resident in atrocity. The Mongols were able to make entire nations submit without a fight, just on the basis of their reputation for exterminating whole cities and nations that had resisted them in the past. The term terrorist simply means one who uses terror. And we don't have to look far around the world or back in history to find instances of individuals and nations who have succeeded in achieving power through the ruthless and effective use of terror. Killing empowerment. Mass murder and execution can be sources of mass empowerment. It is as if a pact with the devil had been made, and a host of evil demons had lived and thrived on the victims of the Nazi SS, to select just one example, empowering its nation with an evil strength as a reward for its blood sacrifices. Each killing affirmed and validated in blood the demon of Nazi racial superiority, thereby establishing a powerful pseudo-speciation, categorizing a victim as an inferior species based on moral distance, social distance, and cultural distance. Dyer's book War has a remarkable photograph of Japanese soldiers bayoneting Chinese prisoners. Prisoners in an endless line are in a deep ditch on their knees with their hands bound behind their backs. Along the banks of the ditch stands another endless line of Japanese soldiers with bayonets fixed on their rifles. One by one, these soldiers go down into the ditch and inflict the intimate brutality of the bayonet on a prisoner. The prisoners hang their heads in dull acceptance and mute horror. Those being bayoneted have their faces contorted in agony. Remarkably, the killers have their faces contorted in a way similar to their victims. In these execution situations, strong forces of moral distance, social distance, cultural distance, group absolution, close proximity, and obedience demanding authority all joined to compel the soldier to execute, overcoming the forlorn forces of his natural and learned decency and his natural resistance to killing. Each soldier who actively or passively participates in such mass executions is faced with a stark choice. On the one hand, the soldier can resist the incredibly powerful array of forces that call for him to kill, and he will instantly be denied by his nation, his leaders, and his friends, and will most likely be executed along with the other victims of this horror. On the other hand, the soldier can bow before the social and psychological forces that demand that he kill, and in doing so, he will be strangely empowered. The soldier who does kill must overcome that part of him that says that he is a murderer of women and children, a foul beast who has done the unforgivable. He must deny the guilt within him, and he must assure himself that the world is not mad, that his victims are less than animals, that they are evil vermin, and that what his nation and his leaders have told him to do is right. He must believe that not only is this atrocity right, but it is proof that he is morally, socially, and culturally superior to those whom he has killed. It is the definitive act of denial of their humanity. It is the ultimate act of affirmation of his superiority. And the killer must violently suppress any dissonant thought that he has done anything wrong. Further, he must violently attack anyone or anything that would threaten his beliefs. His mental health is totally invested in believing that what he has done is good and right. It is the blood of his victims that binds and empowers him to even greater heights of killing and slaughter. And when we realize that this same basic empowering process is what motivates satanic murders and other such cult killings, the analogy of a satanic pact is not as strange as it seems. This is the strength, the power, and the attraction that have resided in human sacrifices over millennia. Bonding the leaders and peers. Those who command atrocities are powerfully bonded by blood and guilt to those who commit atrocities and to their cause, since only the success of their cause can ensure that they will not have to answer for their actions. With totalitarian dictators, it is their secret police and other such Praetorian Guard type units who can be counted on to fight for their leader and their cause to the bitter end. Nicolae Ceaușescu's state police in Romania and Hitler's SS units are two examples of units bonded to their leaders by atrocity. By ensuring that their men participate in atrocities, totalitarian leaders can also ensure that for these minions there is no possibility of reconciliation with the enemy. They are inextricably linked to the fate of their leader, trapped in their logic and their guilt. Those who commit atrocities see no alternatives other than total victory or total defeat in a great Gotterdammerung. In the absence of legitimate threat, leaders, be they national leaders or gang leaders, may designate a scapegoat whose defilement and innocent blood empowers the killers and bonds them to the leaders. Traditionally, high visibility weak groups and minorities, such as Jews and blacks, have filled this role. Women have also been defiled, debased, and dehumanized for the aggrandizement of others. Throughout history, women have been probably the greatest single group of victims of this empowerment process. Rape is a very important part of the process of dominating and dehumanizing an enemy. And this process of mutual empowering and bonding at the expense of others is exactly what occurs during gang rapes. In war, empowerment and bonding through such gang rapes often occur on a national level. The German-Russian conflict during World War II is an excellent example of a vicious cycle in which both sides became totally invested in atrocity and rape. This reached the point at which, according to Albert Seaton, Soviet soldiers attacking Germany were told that they were not accountable for civil crimes committed in Germany, and that personal property and German women were theirs by right. The incidence of rape as a result of these encouragements appears to have been in the millions. Cornelius Ryan, in The Last Battle, estimated that there were 100,000 births resulting from rapes in Berlin alone following World War II. In recent years, we have seen the use of rape as a political tool by all sides in former Yugoslavia, and some Islamist fundamentalists use systematic gang rape to punish women who have violated Islamic law. The thing to understand here is that gang rapes and gang or cult killings in times of peace and war are not senseless violence. They are instead powerful acts of group bonding and criminal enabling that, quite often, have a hidden purpose of promoting the wealth, power, or vanity of a specific leader or cause at the expense of the innocent. Atrocity and denial. The sheer horror of atrocity serves not only to terrify those who face it, but also to generate disbelief in distant observers. Whether it is ritual cult killings in our society or mass murders by established governments in the world at large, the common response is often one of total disbelief. And the nearer it hits to home, the harder we want to disbelieve it. most Americans have been able to accept the millions of murders committed by Nazi Germany because our soldiers were there and were personally exposed to the Nazi death camps. Eyewitness accounts, films, a vocal and powerful Jewish community, and shrines at death camps like Dachau and Auschwitz all combined to make it almost impossible to deny the horror. And yet, even in the face of all this evidence, there is a bizarre minority in our nation and around the world that truly believes that it never happened. The sheer awfulness of atrocity makes us wish it away. And when we are faced with events such as genocide in Cambodia, we would rather turn our heads. David Horowitz, a 1960s radical, writes about how this denial process occurred in him and his friends. I and my former comrades in the left dismissed the anti-Soviet lies about Stalinist repression. And the society we hailed as a new human dawn, 100 million people were put in slave labor camps in conditions rivaling Auschwitz and Buchenwald. Between 30 and 40 million people were killed in peacetime in the daily routine of socialist rule, while leftists applauded their progressive policies and guarded their frontiers. Soviet Marxists killed more peasants, more workers, and even more communists than all the capitalist governments combined since the beginning of time. And for the entire duration of this nightmare, the William Buckleys and Ronald Reagans and other anti-communists went on telling the world exactly what was happening. And all that time, the pro-Soviet left went on denouncing them as reactionaries and liars, using the same contemptuous terms. The left would still be denying the Soviet atrocities if the perpetrators themselves had not finally acknowledged their crime. Although this is a most remarkable example of naivete, a significant and vocal minority in America was trapped in this program of self-deception. Those who were deceived were mainly good, decent, highly educated men and women. It is their very goodness and decency that caused them to be so completely incapable of believing that someone or something they approved of could be so completely evil. Perhaps denial of mass atrocity is tied to our innate resistance to killing. Just as one hesitates to kill in the face of extreme pressure and despite the threat of violence, one has difficulty imagining and believing the existence of atrocity despite the existence of facts. But we must not deny it. If we look around the world carefully, we will find somebody, somewhere, wielding the dark power of atrocity to support a cause that we believe in. It is a simple tenet of human nature that it is difficult to believe and accept that anyone we like and identify with is capable of these acts against our fellow human beings. And this simple, naive tendency to disbelieve or look the other way is, possibly more than any other factor, responsible for the perpetuation of atrocity and horror in our world today.